Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to May's Small Animal Practice Club and Emergency Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce to you our speaker for today, European and RCVS Veterinary Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care, Chiara Valtellina. Thank you, Chiara. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, Sammy Jo. Thank you very much for the introduction. And, well, good afternoon, everyone. So the topic of today, it's the do's and don'ts in emergency medicine. And I got the idea actually discussing with a colleague of mine a few years ago, because we were discussing a little bit, okay, what are the most common, well, let's call them mistakes, but actually things that often veterinarian practice, but also people that work in a university structure, because we are there very busy or they have to deal with a lot of things with emergency patients, they often forget. And so we sort of made a list also based on referral letters we were getting from referring veterinarians, but also, as I said, from things that we were seeing happening with colleagues. And we saw that, yeah, there are few things or few mistakes that keep on coming back. What it's also very important, and again, this is not the idea of this presentation, to point any finger at people that made mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. I made mistakes every day. But the important thing is actually to learn from our mistakes. And that is the only way that we can, again, become better and do better for our patients. So obviously, and only the people that do see patient and work with patient every day are the people that will make the majority of mistakes. And as I said, obviously we are used to deal with emergency patients. And this patient can present in a different variety, again, of way. I mean, often they have an abnormal mental state that can be completely collapsed. Look at this dog, it's not responsive. It's again stuporose or soporose. They might have GI signs, they might have respiratory signs. And again, lots of time as veterinarians, it's very difficult, especially when we are busy, and this is not the only patient we are dealing with. It's very difficult to stay focused for each patient and, again, do the things that really need to be done. So let's see a little bit the do's and don'ts of emergency medicine. Again, when we see this type of patient, what do we have to do and what should we not do? What I see a lot of time happening is that people, especially when they're busy, they do a very quick general physical examination. But this is, for me, it's definitely a don't. It's not doing a very quick physical exam will definitely, again, put you up to make mistake, because you might miss very, very important things. And this is a reason why I'm sure that all of you are aware the way that we do approach our emergency patients are actually following the so-called ABCD, meaning the major body system examination. And we use the ABCD, meaning for A stands for heart rate, B breathing, C cardiovascular system, and D neurological system. Every time we do a triage of our patient, but also every time we want to deepen our physical examination. And again, we have to focus on this major body system, because those major body systems are the most important body system, and we cannot do a quick exam and miss that there is something wrong, for example, with one of them. What I also usually like to suggest is that besides this major body system, something that I see very, very often, it is often forgotten, is actually people forget to look for pain. And I gave, I think, a couple of months ago, actually, a webinar on analgesia on emergency patients. And I said, really, the pain, and we're going to discuss a little bit later, pain recognition and treatment also in our emergency patient is very important. So please don't do quick physical exam on your patient, meaning just having look is doing okay, the pulse is a bit high, but do a very deep, again, physical examination. As I said before, but why we focus on the major body system? Well, again, doesn't actually matter what is the underlying disease the animal is suffering from. Your patient will die very rapidly if he has a problem in one of his major body systems. Let's say that the dog comes in, like the first video that I show you, with some severe hemorrhagic gastroenteritis. Now, the dog will not die of the diarrhea per se, but you will die most likely of hypovolemic shock, or maybe so anemic again that that the anemia will also impact his cardiovascular system. Maybe his glucose has dropped a lot and he again becomes neurologically compromised because of the hypoglycemia. So again, that's why we have to stay focused. That's why we have to focus on our major body system, because that will allow us to triage and also to start initial stabilization of the patient without actually having to have per se a diagnosis. So as I said, we focus on the ABCD, and as I said, I'm sure that you do emergency medicine, so you're aware of that, what that means. Obviously, A stands for highway, so we have first of all to look if there is a patent highway and if the animal is breathing. If the answer is no, well, we already have an answer. This is our obviously emergency patient. But if the patient is also breathing, it's not only recognizing the patient that is severely dyspneic, but we have to look very well at the respiratory pattern. Let's have a look. Is he making the patient making a breathing effort? Where is the breathing effort? Let's try to breathe with the patient. Is it inspiratory, expiratory? Is it a mixed type of dyspnea? Can I hear any sounds again when the animal is breathing? Or without my stethoscope, a stridor, for example, that might be suggestive of an upper airway disease. Or can I hear, for example, a decreased lung sounds when I do listen to the chest, which might be suggestive of pleural space disease. What do I hear on auscultation? So again, focus on the breathing, but not only just to say, yeah, the breathing is higher or it's breathing a bit faster, but also we have to characterize this breathing much better so that we're going to be able actually to try to localize where the problem is and offer our patient the initial best stabilization. We're going to talk obviously a little bit more into detail about the cardiovascular system, because recognizing shock and what type of shock we're dealing with, it's actually, I think, one of the must in emergency medicine. But so C obviously stands for circulation, and also this means that we have to focus on the evaluation of the circulation, which means we're going to obviously count the heart rate, but we also have to feel the pulse and judge the quality of the pulse, listen to the heart, look at the mucous membrane, do the CRT, and again we have to put together all this information to be able to say something about the cardiovascular state of our patient. And D again stands for disability. And sure, I'm not saying that as emergency veterinarian, we have to do a full neurological exam in our patient, but we have to look better about the mentation of our patient and sometimes about the posture that they might assume, because they might telling us a lot. So we're going to look at the mental state, and we're going to try to see if the animal is in lateral recumbency, to try to understand if the lateral recumbency is because there is a real neurological problem or because actually the patient is so sick or in pain or is hypoglycemic or severely hypoperfused that he's unable again to stand up. What I always say, mental status is very important. And again, notice some difference in the mental state of a patient can be quite important also to try to understand what is going on. Now, obviously, everyone is able to recognize an animal that is alert and responsive, but some patients can become obtunded or depressed or soporous, which means that they are mentally quite depressed, but they're still arousable with sort of a normal stimulation. This means that I can pet them, I can call them, I can touch them, and they would sort of respond, a bit, some better, some a bit less. But there are also some patients that can be stuporous. I see it now. Perfect. And again, if you see this is a dog that is, again, lateral recumbency, what I'm doing in this patient, actually just arouse him to make him, to see if there is a response. I'm doing some pretty deep pain, and that was the only way that I could again arouse this patient. So this is a patient that is stuporous, and a patient that is comatose is a patient that no matter what deep pain stimulation I'm going to do, he's not going to respond. So why do I have to make a distinction between again this mental state? Well, we often say the obviously patient that are in shock or in pain, they are very depressed, they can be soporous. But if you have a patient that is also stuporous or a patient that is comatose, don't just look into, for example, shock as the only explanation for the abnormal mental state. Because unless obviously they are in the last phase of the compensated shock, in which I agree sometimes of the mental state can be stuporous, but usually stupor or coma implies something else. They can imply, for example, the presence of hypoglycemia or a primarily central nervous system problem. So again, look very well at the mental state of your patient and try to recognize where is the problem, so that we can better look for eventually another reason, or just say, oh, the animal is in shock, so this is the reason why it's not responding properly and is stuporous. We don't have to be distracted when we evaluate our emergency patient. So obviously this means that that fracturing, that cut, it's horrible. And obviously we know that we have to do something at a certain point for that leg. But remember that patient would probably again die not because of the fractured leg, but because of the blood loss associated to it. And so shock again, maybe the cut is a pneumothorax, et cetera, et cetera. So don't get distracted by the macroscopic fix. Stay focused on your major body system. But you have to be careful, obviously, and that's, I'm sure, this is something that you already know very well. Animals have been bitten, they have some trauma. If you start manipulating them to do a good physical exam, they can be very painful, they can try to bite you. And also, you have to be careful also in patient in which they would assume some strange posture, like the dog, again, on the picture on the right side. I'm sure that all of you have recognized this so-called shift Sherrington positioning. The very stretched foreleg and then hind leg. And shift Sherrington means that most likely there is a severe thoracolumbar spinal lesion. So if you have a patient like this one, you have to be very careful the way you're going to manipulate them, not to make again worse. So I know it's hard. I know when we are very busy and we have more than one patient going on, and we're doing something with a patient and another patient just comes in, there is a lot, that we are doing, and our mind is really full of things that needs to happen. But do a good physical examination is almost half of the work, because if you really are able very quickly and very rapidly in a systematic way to pinpoint what are the major abnormalities in this patient, that will allow you to start again stabilization, and then you can go back to that patient when he's more stable to look for the underlying cause. So please do a very careful physical examination on every patient that comes in, either that seems the most sick one or the less sick one. Remember that again, in emergency medicine, the clinical situation can change so rapidly that even the patient that seems the less sick can become actually, or can destabilize very quickly. So as I said before, cardiovascular examination is very important. It's almost, I'd say, one of the center of the must of emergency medicine. We have to recognize very quickly if an animal is in shock, but also what type of shock that patient is suffering from, because our stabilization will depend on it. So, as I said before, these are the parameters that we have to look when we want to do a good physical exam, cardiovascular. So, heart rate, we do cardiac auscultation, we look at the quality of the pulse, look at the mucous membrane color, our capillary refill time, and the extremity temperature. And we cannot skip any of those. We have to do all of them, then put them together to be able to try to understand what type of shock is it. Another parameter that is not on the slide, but that I use almost in every patient in which I really want to assess them from a cardiovascular point of view, I always shave where the jugular is and look at the jugular distension. If a patient is in shock, for example, we're going to discuss when we're going to talk about the obstructive shock, the jugular can tell you a lot about it, if they are filled and turgid or if they are completely empty. So please remember to shave and look at the jugular in your patient as well. So when we talk about shock, what do we normally expect when a patient is in shock? Let's talk about hypovolemic shock, that is the most common type of shock. Most of the time there is a fluid loss or blood loss, which will decrease your preload, which means the stroke volume will decrease, which means that the cardiac output will decrease. I see someone that is saying that they cannot see the slide. Is there a problem going on? Okay. So the cardiac output again is decreased, and then the blood pressure will decrease. So what is going to happen is that normally the normal response that we would see would be probably that the body will try to increase again the cardiac rate, the cardiac frequency, to try to compensate for the decreasing stroke volume, and then the peripheral resistance will again increase to try to shunt the blood to the most important organ, and then the arterial blood pressure will finally be restabilized. And this is normally a bit what happens in dogs. When we talk about shock in dogs and hypovolemic shock in dogs, the clinical signs that we normally see or we would normally recognize are increase in heart rate, again compensatory, a weak peripheral pulse, obviously because the volume is decreased, pale mucous membrane because of the peripheral vasoconstriction. Your capillary refill time will be obviously prolonged, again peripheral vasoconstriction, and the extremity will be cold. One more time, poor perfusion and peripheral vasoconstriction. When we talk in dogs about distributive shock, so type of shock that can be present with sepsis, anaphylactic shock, systemic inflammatory response syndrome, again, what is in common with this type of, type of shock that is different from the hypovolemic shock, is that there is a profound peripheral vasodilation. You guys remember that toxin or inflammatory cytokines will inhibit the peripheral vasoconstriction. So this patient will be tachycardic, the pulse will be initially a bit bouncing and not very weak, then it will become weak. The mucous membrane, because of the vasodilation, if you look also at the same picture, they will be hyperemic, they will be very red. It's going to be a fast capillary refill time and extremity will be warm. So these are the parameters that you have to recognize that it cannot be associated only to hypovolemia, but they can again pinpoint to distributive shock. When we talk about cardiogenic shock in dog, meaning secondary to obviously a left-sided cardiac failure, both backward and forward failure, usually these patients are tachycardic, they have a weak peripheral pulse because the cardiac output is decreased, they have very pale mucous membrane, prolonged CRT. They often, when you listen to the heart, you often hear a murmur or a gallop, or when you feel the pulse, there is an arrhythmia. They often have distended jugular, and they often are dyspneic because if the left side is involved, then to have a forward failure, most of the time there is also some lung congestion. So again, this is going to help you to look and to distinguish this type of shock from a simple hypovolemic shock. When we talk about obstructive shock, for example, from pericardial effusion, then again, all these parameters, what you will see would be tachycardia. Again, the pulse obviously will be weak because there is not enough blood going back to the heart because of, for example, either in case of GDV or in case, for example, obstructive shock. So you're going to have pale mucous membrane, your prolonged CRT. But again, when you listen to the heart here, you will not hear very well the heart sounds because there is obviously fluid around the heart. And one more time, if you look at the jugular this time, they will be extremely distended and turgid, and they will not be empty or they will not be collapsed. So that, again, looking at the jugular, not hearing the heart, is what sometimes is going to help you rapidly to make a distinction between hypovolemia and obstructive shock. Also, the presence eventually of the pulsus paradoxus. When we talk about cats, again, lots of time, what I see also by people, also again, also colleagues that work with me, they often try to use the same parameters to judge shock in cats as they was used in dogs. So again, they say, yeah, okay, so cats, they will become more tachycardic, they pain, they want to see the pain mucous membrane, they want to see the weak pulse, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we have to remember that obviously cats are very much different than dogs, and they do respond to shock also very much different. So don't underestimate signs of shock in cats. Cats, they can come in shock and actually have a kind of a normal physical exam, and some of them actually they can be quite collapsed. But what is very important to remember about cats is that cats often that are in shock develop an inappropriate bradycardia. So don't expect to see in cats the same clinical signs as you would see in dogs when they're in shock, or meaning an increase in the heart rate, because some of them will actually drop the heart rate even below 120, 130. So again, what we expect to see in cats that, let's say again, there is a dopamine preload, drop in stroke volume, drop in cardiac output. So ideally, they should increase the cardiac frequency to maintain the perfusion, but they often don't. The cardiac frequency often drops, which again means that the cardiac output will drop and their arterial pressure will drop. So That's why often, I'm sure you heard about it, when we talk about shocking cats, we talk about the triad of shocking cats, which is a combination between bradycardia, obviously because of the poor perfusion and the drop in cardiac output, you have an hypotension. Because of the hypotension and the poor perfusion, they become hypothermic, and that will worsen the bradycardia. And why is that? Because hypothermia will decrease the responsiveness of the receptor for the circulating catecholamine, which means that cat might have the same amount of circulating adrenaline or adrenaline that dogs in shock have, but their receptor, their adrenoceptor is not working, they're not working properly, so cats are unable to use, let's say, the circulating catecholamine to respond properly to shock. So don't underestimate signs of shock in cats. Don't underestimate the fact that cats in shock might lower the heart rate. So don't say the heart rate in this cat, it's not actually high enough, so this cat cannot be in shock. No, no, no. The cat can definitely be in shock despite having a lower heart rate than normal. So again, this is a bit what I said before. So inappropriate bradycardia, obviously some cats will also be tachycardic. So that's what I mean. Just looking at heart rate is not going to help you, but you often have to do a good physical exam. The problem in cats is that it doesn't matter what type of shock they're suffering from, they will present a bit the same. So bradycardia, tachycardia, pale mucous membrane, hypotension and hypothermia. In cats also, what we don't see, unfortunately, we don't see signs of what we call it the hyperdynamic shock, meaning that shock is quite often in the compensated phase. So often if you have a cat that is in sepsis or has systemic inflammatory response syndrome, let's say in distributive shock, don't expect to see in this cat red mucous membrane, fast CRT, bounding pulse. Those signs don't exist in cats, or not so commonly as they would in dog. And that's why there are some tables that you could use, even if they're not very specific, to diagnose. Again, this is, for example, a table that we often use to diagnose criteria of systemic inflammatory response in cats. So you look at the temperature, the heart rate, for example, respiratory rate, the number of white blood cells or the bands that are present. And if cats have 3 out of 4 of these abnormalities, then we can assume that the cat is probably suffering from distributive shock or systemic inflammatory response syndrome. In your emergency patient, again, what I often see that some people, or they do a lot of blood work, or they often don't do a lot of blood work. And I know that a lot of time there is no time, and I don't say that this has to be done initially, absolutely in every patient before we do free therapy, or even before we give analgesia. But at a certain point, we have to have an emergency database. And emergency database, it's a database that you can do even in your in every practice, doesn't have to, you don't have to have a big lab that runs all the blood work for you, but it will give you some idea what is going on. And usually emergency database means you need an hematocrit and a total protein, and you can also use a microhematocrit and a refractometer to read the total protein. A glucose, again, you can use a glucometer. Urea and crea ideally would be nice, but again, at least the creatinine and at least the electrolyte, the natrium and the potassium. Why do we do that? Because it can give you rapidly an idea what is going on, obviously. They might allow you to stabilize the patient, especially if hypoglycemia is present. And sometimes, especially in polytraumatized or traumatized patients, having an idea or looking at what's happening between the relationship between hematocrit and the total protein can also give you quite some information for a possible initial blood loss. Remember that in dogs, especially in acute blood loss, we will have an initial drop in your total protein and albumin, while your hematocrit initially will stay the same because of the splenic contraction that would release a lot of, again, red blood cell. So again, the emergency database is something that I think every patient should have at a certain point during their initial hospitalization. Do I have to wait for my fluid therapy or my oxygen therapy to get the blood of this patient? The answer for me is no. I definitely stabilization of shock or stabilization of dyspnea is the priority, but at a certain point would be nice to have again a base for you to say something what's going on with this patient. Another thing that I see actually very commonly about fluid therapy, and what I often see is that it doesn't often matter how big the patient is. The patient always receives one bottle of fluid, which it's usually 500 milliliter, and that doesn't matter if it's again a Jack Russell Terrier or if it's a Great Dane or another huge dog. And obviously, it's very important to remember that for a teeny tiny dog, maybe 500 milliliters to treat shock might be way too much, while for obviously a big patient might be almost nothing. So it's very important when we start fluid therapy that we do it again in a systematic and in an appropriate way. So we do have to use an adequate amount of fluid. But to make a responsible choice, we also have to know our fluid. We need to know how much we can use and how fast we can use them. We need to titrate them to the severity of hypoperfusion. And this is why there are no recipe when we talk about fluid therapy in small animals. And they also need to be titrated for the patient, which means that when we start our fluid therapy, the only way to know that our fluid therapy is making what I want it to do, meaning treating the shock or solving the hypoperfusion, it's just by keep on checking in your patient. So just giving a bottle of fluid to any patient that is in shock and not checking what that fluid is doing, it's not treating shock. It's not doing good fluid therapy. So what fluid do we have available? Now, I'm sure all of you use crystalloids. Crystalloids is what I use also every day. They are available everywhere. And you know that they're usually classified based on their tonicity compared to the plasma, to hypotonic, isotonic to the plasma, hypertonic to the plasma. What do we know about the crystalloids? That they redistribute rapidly. So this means that after an hour, usually there is 30-40% of your bolus that have you given to that patient is still in circulation. The rest will redistribute. Now, what is important to remember is that actually hypotonic fluid, meaning every fluid that has a sodium concentration below the sodium concentration of the patient, so the plasma, and that contains glucose, they do contain an amount of free water, which make them hypotonic solution when you give it to the patient. The problem of this hypotonic solution is that they are not good for fluid replacement. They will decrease the osmolarity of the plasma. They will decrease the sodium of the patient. So they actually can cause severe hyponatremia and they can distribute very rapidly to the intracellular compartment for which they can be responsible for the development of brain edema. So hypotonic crystalloid solution should never be used ever as fluid replacement in shock for your patient. And unfortunately, be careful, because if you only look at what is written on the bottle, sometimes you would see that the osmolarity, even of 5% glucose, that is one of the most hypotonic solution, it's normal. But the problem is that that is because in vitro there is glucose in there that contribute to the osmolarity. But once that solution is given to the patient and the glucose used, that what you're giving to that patient in that moment is just free water. That is going to definitely do more harm than good. So never consider hypotonic crystalloid solution for treating shock in your patient. We mainly use isotonic crystalloids. Doesn't matter what you use, there are different type, Ringer solutions, Sterfundin, Hartmann, sodium chloride, they're usually the first choice. How much to give? And this is again something that I see, the dose is still a big problem, and I see a lot of people making still some mistake in it. And this I think is because still in the majority of emergency and critical care books, there are still this very old dose that is reported, and sometimes reported as a dose, sometimes as a rate. I'm sure all of you have heard about the shock dose in dogs and cats. 80 to 90 milliliter per kilo in dogs, sometimes there is also an hour, and suggesting a rate, and in cats 50 to 60. But I'm 100% sure that all of you have noticed that not every patient in shock suffers from the same degree of shock. And this is why I think that the standard approach to hypovolemia, a bottle or two bottles, might actually not be correct, because not every patient suffers from the same degree of shock, means that not every patient requires the same amount of fluid. And if I only remember, I only use the shock dose of crystalloids to treat shock, then I'm actually just applying to every patient the same amount, which is not correct, which means that for a patient might be way too much and for the other patient might be way too little. So now we normally, when we talk about fluid therapy, we do we think about a bolus of fluid as initial treatment, and these are just guidelines and are different ways of doing fluid therapy. But we can also often, if we remember that shock dose, it's fine, but then we have to consider to use 1/4, 1/3, or half of that dose as our initial bolus, depending on the severity, again, of the hypoperfusion, hypovolemia. So I would start with 10/20 in a dog or 5/10 in a cat, and not give the full 80 to 90 milliliter per kilo per hours. And how fast are we going to give that fluid? We're going to give it fast. We don't wait for an hour. We give it in 15, 30 minutes. That is a bolus of fluid. And this is where I see that a lot of people still make a lot of mistakes, because and they use the shock dose and they give it in an hour, because this is often what is written in books, but this is not correct. Shock should be treated rapidly with an amount of fluid. We need to reevaluate our patients and then decide if we need to give more. Hypertonic steroid solution, we don't use them very often. I don't know how many of you actually use it. Obviously, because it's hypertonic, concentrated, it works by pulling fluid from the interstitial space, intracellular space, back into the intravascular compartment. So actually, you need very little to have the same effect of a crystalloid bolus. But we mainly, so that's why you actually use almost 10 times less the amount to have the same effect of a bolus of a crystalloid solution. As I said, we don't use this first line, but we would use it either if you have a huge patient that is not dehydrated, and that's why I often use GDV as a possible example, because obviously if it's dehydrated, then that fluid is not going to work because it doesn't have enough fluid from the intravascular interstitial space to use. And also it's been shown in patients that are hypoperfused with head trauma to have a protective effect on the brain. So you could use this first line fluid resuscitation in, again, hypoperfused patient with traumatic brain injury to reestablish perfusion and to protect the brains against a worsening of the edema. Now, colloid solution, again, after what happened in human mess, I don't know how many of you, again, have it available or still use it. Obviously, we still use it in veterinary medicine. There is not yet a huge amount of evidence that colloid solution in veterinary medicine cause severe side effects, but obviously we have to be aware about them. They are a crystalloid solution that contains macromolecules. These macromolecules that will not cross your endothelial membrane, of the vascular system, that will stay in circulation. But colloid, the one that we use the most, obviously, is the hydroxylase starches, which are polymers of amylopectin, which have been modified in the lab to prolong, again, their staying into the intravascular compartment and again, the resistance to degradation from the enzyme. What are the indications for colloid solution? As I say, we don't often use them as first line, but we often would use them when we use crystalloid solution in a patient and that patient doesn't seem to respond properly. Or if that patient doesn't have enough support of his own colloid oncotic pressure because he's severely hypoalbuminemic, acute decrease in albumin might require maybe use of colloid solution. We often use it in situations in which we have increased vascular permeability, vasculitis, to decrease the extravasation of fluid into the interstitial space. And again, we often use as a small bolus. I will not start with a full dose as initial bolus, which is usually 20 to 30 milliliter per kilo per day max, but I would use with a 5 to 10 and give it and then repeat your physical exam and see what happened and then decide if you want to give more. As I said before, obviously there are concerns when we use colloid solution that even if we don't see them so often in veterinary medicine, we know they are there, so we have to be aware of them. We know they might cause some coagulopathy, so they might decrease platelet aggregability and the activity of factor VIII. And in human medicine, the worst side effects that are afraid when they use colloid, especially in septic patient population, is the development of renal insufficiency. So again, if you use colloid, it's fine. Choose your patient and be aware that some side effects might be present. But as I said, obviously crystalloid solution would be my first line and colloid solution still could be used. when we talk about cats, because we talked before about cats, and cats, as you see, we use obviously lower amount of fluid therapy, and because cats are not very good in dealing with fluid as dogs are. And this is, for me, again, is something that I see very, very often happening, that again, people would do fluid therapy in cats as they would do it in dog, meaning they would give a big amount of fluid very quickly, thinking, oh, I do it in dogs, I'll do it in cats the same. But unfortunately, no, cats are not good in dealing with a large amount of fluid. So it's very easy to push a hypotensive, hypothermic, hypovolemic cat into, again, lung edema and pleural effusion because we give a large amount of fluid. So in cats, actually, so the dos in cats fluid therapy is not giving a bolus of fluid as in dogs, but it's actually to give a smaller bolus. We call it small volume resuscitation, and then repeat that bolus until we're happy that the cat is not in shock. So I would start with 10 to 20 milliliters per kilo bolus max in, 15, 30 minutes. In the meantime, obviously start rewarming the cat and then eventually reassess. And as I said, assessing a cat while you're giving fluid therapy, especially if it's hypotensive, especially if it's hypothermic, means that you don't only have to check your perfusion parameters, but also your respiratory parameters. Because one of the first things you're going to see if you're giving too much fluid or too fast is that that cat is going to go into, again, lung edema, or it will develop pleural effusion. Obviously, a huge don't, and unfortunately, there are still a lot of colleagues that do that, is actually to give in an animal in shock subcutaneous fluid therapy or drugs. Now, we just say before that because one of the classic compensatory mechanisms to shock is peripheral vasoconstriction, this means that there is very little perfusion to the subcutaneous area. So if you have an animal that is in shock, where you want your fluid to go fast into the intravascular space, and you give him even a lot of fluid in the subcutaneous space, that fluid will stay there, nothing is going to happen, will not get absorbed, and your patient will most likely die because that fluid didn't help him. So never, ever use, it's pointless to use fluid subcutaneously in an hypovolemic, hypotensive, hypoperfused patient with the hope that I'm going to improve the perfusion. It's not going to happen. So, but you also have to think, if you want to give drugs to a patient that is still perfused, hypovolemic, and you give it subcutaneously, you don't know how much of that drug is going to get absorbed. So that's why, if possible, if the drugs allow you, give it IV if you have an IV line, or choose maybe the intramuscular route, because again, muscles are being more perfused than your subcutaneous, and you have more chance that the drug will be absorbed. So please never subcutaneous fluid or drug in an hypovolemic, hypotensive patient. Another big point is patients that have very low body temperature or very high body temperature, what to do with it? And the don'ts are, don't warm, at least if the patient is hypothermic, don't warm them up too quickly. Or too slowly, obviously. We have to find a sort of a middle way, especially if your patient is also hypovolemic or hypoperfused. Because again, imagine you have a patient that is hypovolemic, is using his peripheral vasoconstriction to shunt blood to the most important organ, and you're gonna, and is obviously hypothermic because there is not enough perfusion. I was just talking about a cat, and you put a nice lamp on him or a nice, again, electric blanket to increase rapidly his body temperature. First thing that happens is peripheral vasodilation, and the perfusion drops even further because the blood is going to be pulled to the periphery. So it's always very important that you warm them up slowly while your fluid therapy is actually on the way, meaning while you're actually start treating the shock. However, you have to treat, obviously, even if slowly, you have to warm them up, because an hypovolemic and severe hypothermic patients, its vessel will be less responsive to your fluid therapy. So this means that if your animal is severe hypothermic and you give a lot of fluid and you think, oh, it's not getting better, let me give more, you have the risk actually to give a lot of fluid, and what you see is just that the patient is not responsive because the vessels are poorly responsive. So again, try to find a sort of a middle way, start treating your hypovolemia, your hypoperfusion, and rewarm the patient. And obviously, it's important to rewarm them. You can use a blanket, you can use a bear rug, you can still use the lamp and an electric blanket, but just careful not to increase too quickly the body temperature. bit of a different story is actually when you have high temperature, and then you actually have to cool them down a bit too quickly because hyperthermia is very, very bad, let's say, for your patient. But again, a don't of cooling down a patient is using ice or wrapping them nicely in wet towel. And that, unfortunately, is what I see sometimes. It is still happening. One of the way of an animal, of hyperthermic animal, to get rid of the heat is by, again, evaporative cooling. Means that the blood would flow to the periphery and the worms will evaporate. If you wrap an animal with a wet towel, you're going to create again a humid environment where the heat cannot escape. So actually the temperature will not drop. And the ice, why not? Well, again, if you put your animal hyperthermic in ice or in contact with the ice, besides being very painful, what you're going to do, actually ice in contact with the skin will cause vasoconstriction, which again means that the heat will not escape outside, but will go back to the core and the blood and the temperature will not drop. So do not use ice, do not use wet towel if you want to cool down an hyperthermic patient. So what are we going to do? Again, spray your patient with water. You can use alcohol, and not just on the paws, but on the abdomen, on the back of everywhere. And then try to use a source of cool air in front of the dog to allow the evaporative cooling, the heat to go away. Sometimes people use also bladder lavage, so placing a bladder catheter, urinary catheter, and start lavaging it a little bit to try again to get some cold fluid in contact with the mucosa. And you know, I'm sure that you have to cool them down often, not to a normal body temperature. So don't cool them down until they're 38, but do cool them down until they're 39.5 in body temperature. Because once you then stop your active cooling, the temperature will keep on dropping. And if you stop your active cooling when the patient is 38 degrees, yeah, then you have the risk that they will develop hypothermia, they will start shivering, and again, you go into sort of a vicious circle. Sometimes, obviously, I already know, might be necessary to also sedate some of the patient, depending again what is the underlying reason for the hyperthermia to develop. That is another big one. Dexamethasone in emergency medicine in patient in shock. Should I use again corticosteroids to treat patient in shock? I think this is a big don't. It's a urban legend, and unfortunately, again, a lot of people still use it because it was written, and unfortunately, still written in some books, that dexamethasone administration increase a stabilization of cellular membrane, decrease inflammatory mediators, and help resolving the shock. Well, again, it is absolutely not true, so do not use it. Giving corticosteroids to an animal in shock will cause hyperglycemia, which will increase diuresis. Actually, corticosteroids themselves will cause polyuria, which in an animal with already a problem with this fluid balance, imagine that you cause a severe polyuria because of your corticosteroids. Well, I'm not doing very well then. I'm trying to give him fluid, but in the meantime, I'm helping him to pee even more. We cause immunosuppression, will decrease again wound healing, can predispose that patient to gastrointestinal bleeding and ulceration, and it might hinder your further diagnostic. So actually dexamethasone doesn't have a role to treat for the treatment of shock in emergency patient. Yes, corticosteroids should be used in Addisonian crisis, in the treatment obviously of your immunomediated anemia or immunomediated thrombocytopenia, in anaphylactic shock when there is a severe again cardiovascular compromise. So I'm not saying obviously never use corticosteroids, but don't use them with the idea that a big dose of dex will help to solve shock in your patient. I'm sure all of you have heard about the so-called CIRSE, corticosteroid-related adrenal insufficiency, which actually means that, at least in human medicine, veterinary medicine, there's still a lot of discussion about it, where corticosteroids are sort of used for the stabilization of patient that is in a specific phase of shock, meaning septic shock. But septic shock, the definition per se, means again a patient that is in sepsis, in shock, and is hypotensive, and his hypotension doesn't respond to fluid therapy. In this situation, we can consider them, but not in every patient that is in shock, in which you haven't even yet given fluid therapy to improve perfusion. So, as I said, corticosteroids in shock don't have a role in a specific subpopulation, might, and obviously, yeah, for the treatment of some specific disease, yes. This is another thing that I see very often. People often, in an animal with pleural effusion, they use a lot of furosemide, to get rid of the pleural effusion. But this is a don't. Do not only use furosemide to treat pleural effusion. Furosemide alone will not get rid of the pleural effusion. So your patient will probably die of dyspnea and of dehydration. Furosemide is a loop diuretic, decrease the preload, but as I said, it will not get rid of a pleural effusion. So when we have an animal with a pleural effusion, a pleural space disease, we have to do a thoracocentesis. There is no way around it. Obviously, if, for example, we're talking about a cat that has a pleural effusion because of left-sided heart failure, I might use also furosemide as part of my stabilization, but still I have to do thoracocentesis to get rid of that fluid in the pleural space to allow my patient to breathe better. And this is just how to do thoracocentesis, but I'm sure that all of you know how to do thoracocentesis. Where do we do it? Dorsal, if it's a pneumothorax, a bit more 1-2 ventral again, for pleural effusion, cranial to the rib, 7, 8, 8, 9 intercostal space. Always shave again very well. Try to clean aseptically, prepare aseptically the area. And always remember to keep some of that fluid for further analysis. Don't throw that fluid always away. For a cat, we can use a butterfly with a three-way stopcock and a small syringe. For a dog, you can use also three-way stopcock, a sort of a connection system, and a needle of adequate size, depending on the size, obviously, of the dog. And again, most of the time, an animal is in, again, sternal recumbency, and often sedation might not be necessary, just some gentle restraint. Eventually, sometimes you have to sedate gently this patient. And as you can see, you introduce the needle, first perpendicular, then you bend the needle a bit against the thoracic wall, and then obviously you aspirate to get rid of the fluid. So again, furosemide, as I say, I'm not saying it's not helpful, but only when furosemide is used to treat eventually the underlying cause of the pleural effusion, but not to get rid of the pleural effusion alone. Do a thoracocentesis to stabilize this patient. Also, sometimes what I see, especially in a bit less experienced veterinarians, is that they have an animal, especially if it's a young animal, but can also be, as I said, a bit middle-aged dog that comes in again, I think is in shock or whatever clinical signs, dementation, these patients are stuporose and still they don't check glucose. Now, it's, as I say, everyone has probably a glucometer. Glucose should be part of your emergency database, and it's very easy to rule in or rule out hypoglycemia. And hypoglycemia is the responsible of severe neurological signs, abnormal mentation, irritability, weakness, seizure. So I would check glucose in every animal that comes in with seizure. And as I say, not only puppy or kitten, but middle-aged dog can have, for example, insulinoma. There is a big range of disease that could cause hypoglycemia, leiomyoma, leiomyosarcoma. So I would always check it in every animal that comes in with an abnormal mental state, with a stuporous mental state. It's very easy to check and it's very easy to treat. So check for hypoglycemia. How do I treat it? Now, don't use 5% glucose to treat hypoglycemia. There is very, very little glucose in 5% glucose. So this means that you will have to give a lot of that fluid that we just said before. It's a hypotonic solution. So you will actually cause some problem to that patient. Use then a more concentrated glucose solution. 0.1 to 1 milliliter per kilo of a 20% solution, usually a bit diluted, as a bolus. And if you have to continue giving glucose to that patient, again, don't use 5% glucose. Make your own glucose infusion. Use a bottle of NaCl, Hartmann, Ringer lactate, and add to that solution an amount of glucose to make it a 2.5% or a 5% glucose, so that you're giving an isotonic solution to that patient that contains glucose as well. Another thing that I say don't, and again, I've seen using it a lot of time, lots of people still use the 5% glucose saying, my patient is not eating, I want to give some energy, some nutrition, let's use 5% glucose. Actually, as I said before, there is very, very little glucose and kilocalorie in a liter of 5% glucose. And I wrote a sort of an estimation for a 4-kilo cat, said it, let's say it would require 190, 180 kilocalorie per day, as RER. To get to that, you will have to give almost a liter and 200 milliliter of a 5% glucose, which is almost 4 or 5 times the normal maintenance of that patient. So, and if you give less than that, you give nothing. And if you give more than that, you give actually fluid that can be harmful to that patient. So don't think that you're going to provide nutrition by using 5% glucose. If you really want to do proper nutrition in your patient, then consider placing a feeding tube, for example, nasogastric, nasopharyngeal, or eventually use parenteral nutrition, but not 5% glucose. As I said, I did a webinar a few months ago on treatment of pain, but I wanted again to mention it here because this is for the people again that didn't listen to the webinar, because this is again is a source of often a lot of still mistakes, and a lot of people see don't treat again pain in our emergency patient, while actually it are probably the population that suffer from the major degree of pain, especially acute pain. And these are a bit older, fair enough. Article, but again, they show that the majority of emergency patient pain is usually not evaluated and treated a bit too late. There are now available, obviously recognition of pain is quite difficult, but now we have a lot of things, of scales that we can use to rapidly evaluate pain. And as here, this is the short form, the Glasgow Composite Pain Scale, and the other one is the Colorado State for cats. And recently, a few years ago, the UNES Botucatu Multidimensional Pain Scale in cats has also been validated for the evaluation of acute pain in cats. So let's say that now we really don't have any excuse not to use a pain scale to evaluate how painful our animal is. If we don't have time because we are very busy, we have a 3 emergency, please then, if you think your animal can be painful, then treat the pain. You're going to use the pain scale to evaluate the effect of your treatment, but do not give analgesia. But if you're thinking about analgesia, remember in an emergency patient not to use non-steroidal. And unfortunately, I think the majority of veterinarians still know it, but because they think it's not cardiovascularly harmful, doesn't give any sedation, it's often still one of the preferred analgesia in an emergency patient. But actually, we should really not consider it. Why is that? Because actually patients that are in shock or hypertensive or severely dehydrated, or they have already a coagulopathy, they're already on corticosteroids, or they have renal disease or GI disease, you can worsen the clinical situation. You can cause more damage actually than good. We know that non-steroidals block your cyclooxygenase, which will block then the production of prostaglandin. And we know the prostaglandin in physiology are very important for the perfusion to the gastrointestinal mucosa, and are used for the kidney to regulate, auto-regulate the diameter of the afferent arteriola at the glomerulus site. So if in a patient, again, that is hypotensive, hypovolemic, we use a non-steroidal, we put them at risk of developing acute renal failure and GI bleeding or GI ulceration. And actually, it doesn't really matter which non-steroidal you choose. That's something that I've heard as well, saying, oh, it doesn't matter, I'm going to use a selective COX-2, because we know that COX-2 is actually, they say, the cyclooxygenase, which is induced by inflammation. So this means that if I use a selective one, it will not have any effect on the cyclooxygenase one, so it will not affect my prostaglandin. Well, it would be great, but it is not true. It has actually been shown that both COX-1 and COX-2, they have some physiological effect, and the distinction between the inducible form or not inducible form is not so black and white. So even if you're using a COX-2 selective non-steroidal in a patient, again, that suffers from shock, hypotension, hypovolemia, still, that patient can develop severe side effects. So COX-2 selective doesn't mean that they are safer to use. I remember that. So again, they can be nephrotoxic, because by decreasing production of prostaglandin, it means that it will cause, again, the vasoconstriction of your glomerular capillary, and you would predispose your patient to develop tubular medullary necrosis. And also, as I say before, because in an animal that is hypotensive, in shock, hypoperfused, the perfusion of the GI mucosa is very decreased. If I give in that patient something that will decrease also the production of prostaglandin, so will decrease the ability of that patient to have some extra perfusion to the mucosa, well, then that patient definitely is at risk of developing GI ulceration. So what to use in this patient? Do use your pyrimiopoid. Don't worry about what people often say, severe side effects, respiratory depression, bradycardia. For sure those side effects can be there, but only if you use them at very high dose, not at the analgesic dose. So using methadone or morphine or fentanyl or sulfentanyl, it will give you a very good analgesia, rapid analgesia. You can titrate the analgesia. If you see any side effects, you can reverse them with, for example, naloxone. So they're actually very safe analgesic, also in cats and in dogs. My preferred analgesic in an emergency patient, cats or dogs, is methadone. I usually start with a 0.1, 0.2 milligram per kilo, IV slowly, and I titrate that amount to effect in a later stage when my patient is more stable. Buprenorphine, this is another thing that I see very often, is a do's or a don't. Should I use buprenorphine in emergency patients? And again, lots of time again, veterinarians choose buprenorphine because they feel safer to use buprenorphine than a pure opioid, because fair, buprenorphine has a bit less side effects. Buprenorphine is a partial agonist that sits and blocks your mu receptor very tightly, which is good, obviously, good for moderate mild pain. But remember a few things about buprenorphine. It takes a while to work, 30 to 45 minutes. It cannot be antagonized. And the problem is that you cannot use any extra analgesia to that patient if you use buprenorphine. You cannot use a pure mu opioid if you use buprenorphine because it will not work, because obviously the pure mu receptor will be already used by the buprenorphine. So if you have a patient in which you think that surgery might be required in a short time after hospitalization, think GDV, for example, foreign body, hemoabdomen, I don't know, maybe using buprenorphine might not be the best choice, because then during anesthesia, it means that for 6 hours you cannot use high dose of pyrimiopoid as part of your anesthetic regimen. Obviously, if nothing better, meaning if you don't have a pyrimiopoid, then buprenorphine is much better than a non-steroidal. But if you could choose, then I would always choose probably a pyrimiopoid, as I say, like methadone or sulfentanil or fentanyl. Another important thing that I see again as a mistake done quite often is that you have a surgical patient, people get a surgical, let's say, or an emergency patient with a possible surgical disease, and for example, in this case, you see classic presentation of a hemoabdomen. So patient comes in shock, anemic, distended abdomen, ondulation positive. You do a quick echo, a fast, there is fluid, you tap it, blood. And often what I see is that then a lot of time, like, okay, it's a surgical patient, let me call the surgeon. This dog needs to go immediately to surgery, because if I don't remove that spleen, or if I don't stop the bleeding, or again, if GDV doesn't get immediately resolved after, then it's a problem. I'm not saying the surgery is not necessary. Surgery is necessary, but it's not an emergency. So it's not, I have to go to the OR now. No, this means that, again, you can predispose that patient to die during anesthesia, to do worse in the postoperative period. So remember, so the do's here are stabilize your patients as much as you can, and let's say, obviously, in a limit, in a time limit, before you bring him to surgery. Often patients that have a surgical disease that requires surgery and come in so bad as an emergency, they often suffer from coagulopathy, which can be because of loss, so maybe they have, again, a problem that causes coagulopathy. They might be severely anemic. they might suffer from severe abnormality, electrolyte abnormalities. I'm really thinking about some severe intestinal foreign body that have been there for a while. They might have arrhythmias. All these, they have to be, let's say, stabilized, as I said, in the limit as much as possible before that patient goes for surgery. Why? Remember that those patients that comes to you, they have still able, with a compensatory mechanism, to, let's say, be alive, actually. You know, or the compensatory mechanism for shock, and they can, yes, they can compensate. But as soon as you anesthetize them, all anesthetic drugs that we use, doesn't matter if it's a better one or a worse one, they will predispose to bradycardia, they will predispose to hypotension. And actually, all anesthetic drugs will blunt the ability of that patient to compensate and to respond to shock. So if you don't stabilize hypoperfusion, shock, arrhythmia, etc., etc., before you go to surgery, anesthetize this patient, that patient, once he's under general anesthesia, is going to be even worse hypoperfused. So you are going to see severe hypotension, and it's going to be too late then to treat them while they're anesthetized. So fundamental for you to your priorities is to try to improve as much as possible signs of shock and cardiovascular parameters with fluid, with blood, depending obviously what's going on. Look at the electrolyte abnormalities, especially hypokalemia, hyperkalemia. They need to be controlled as much as possible before you go to surgery. And obviously, if you also have a very low hematocrit, if your patient is also anemic, that also ideally needs to be controlled with a blood transfusion before they go to surgery. So we have to try to improve our systemic perfusion and our cardiac function, our blood pressure, before that patient goes to surgery. Now, what I don't mean is that you have to wait for hours before you reach your, let's say, end goal. Obviously, having a hemo-abdomen that bleeds for hours is not a good idea, but you might take an hour or a bit longer, it depends, but an hour is often enough to start fluid resuscitation, to give analgesia, to optimize the perfusion, to find some blood eventually, to transfuse the blood. So again, stabilization is mandatory before every patient goes to surgery. And sometimes when surgery are not real surgical, let's call them emergency, intestinal foreign body, and your patient is severely hypotensive, dehydrated with severe electrolyte abnormalities, might not be a terrible idea, obviously discussing with the owner, to maybe postpone the surgery again until your patient is quite stable. Which the last things are, again, that it's sometimes what I see also happening a lot. And again, the problem I realize often is there is a lot to do and I don't have time to write on the chart everything, is that sometimes the monitoring of the patients that they've been initially stabilized and then admitted to an intensive care, a recovery room, it's a bit suboptimal. Every emergency patient, and this is actually typical of an emergency patient, is that their situation can change very rapidly. So they can be stable and then you go and look at them half an hour later and they are bad or worse even before when they came in. So, and this is why, obviously, in intensive care, in emergency room, we monitoring cardiovascular exam, respiratory rate and effort, body temperature, pain scoring, urinary production if possible, really initially every 1 to 2 hours, because what we want is to be able to pick up ahead any possible deterioration of the patient before, again, they decompensate completely. Blood pressure also is an important parameter that might give you quite some information on the cardiovascular stability of that patient. But monitoring might not be also enough. And lots of time, as I said before, you're busy, so you might not be yourself to do the monitoring. Maybe it's a nurse that works with you, it's a colleague that works with you, it's a student that works with you. So what is also very important, because to make sure that things don't go missed, is actually that you write clearly on your chart, or you give clearly instruction, or what are the intervention parameters. So only monitoring and say, yeah, the heart rate is 100. It's not enough because maybe for that patient, 100 is pretty high if you always had an error rate of 50. So it's good for us to communicate clearly or to write clearly on the chart what are the limit of intervention. So say if the heart rate of this dog goes above 80, then call me or look further. Is he losing blood? Is he becoming more hypovolemic? So it's always fundamental that we write clearly on the patient chart the limits. And what I found always very, very clear for me and much easier also to read, especially if I'm very busy, is to make a chart like the one that I put on my slide. Which means that if I write only the value, then it takes me a little bit more time to have an idea. Okay, what's been happening with the heart rate? It was 90, then it went to 100, then 150. If I actually visually can look easily at what's been happening with a chart, it gives me also a very good idea that that heart rate that was very high initially then finally drop. So, okay, my patient remains stable. Maybe the body temperature is now increasing. So that might be a way, try to make a way that works for you as easy as possible for you to have on a glance actually an idea what's happening with that patient. Again, if you're not the person doing the monitoring. And again, act rapidly. It's fundamental because that's the whole point of monitoring, to be able to pick up very rapidly those abnormalities and not just sitting on a value that was abnormal because we didn't know, because no one told us, because that person was not informed. So this is what I have for all of you today. And as I said, these are a bit the do's and don'ts, or let's say the mistakes that I've seen happening quite often in a busy practice. I see there is a question, and the question is, what about lactate as part of your emergency database? It's a very interesting question. Yeah, lactate, it's an important parameter for sure, and lactate will give you definitely an idea of the severity of the hyperperfusion, and we know there should be less than 2 or 2.5 millimoles per liter, depending on which machine you're using to evaluate the lactate. But my sometimes point of view, again, obviously lactate for sure, it's a useful adjunct to your emergency database. But if I don't have lactate, am I not able to assess perfusion? Well, the answer is obviously not. Sure, that I am able to assess perfusion. My physical examination, anamnesis of the patients, my repeated assessment, I've sometimes found them even more reliable than just one value of lactate done on admission. Lactate can be definitely useful eventually to monitor the response of that patient to your fluid therapy. So if a patient comes in with a lactate of 8 or 10 and you start your fluid resuscitation and you recheck lactate in an hour or 2 hours and that lactate is coming down, well, then obviously it means that your perfusion is getting better. But I hope that you're going to be able to assess it also on your patient. You will probably see on that patient some cardiovascular parameter changing and improving. And also remember that I know a lot of people still use a lot lactate as a sort of prognosis parameter or prognosticating factor. There's been a lot published on lactate about using lactate in GDV. If they're above 8 or above 10, it means it's gastronecrosis, et cetera, et cetera. Remember that all these papers that have been published on lactate, where lactate has been used as a prognosticating factor, that values are for a specific population, and we should never use that value of lactate, for example, to give a prognosis for a single patient, because it would be wrong. I would never suggest to euthanize a dog that comes in with a GDV that has a lactate of 10, because I'm 100% sure that the dog has a gastric necrosis. That lactate of 10 will just be in my mind, and I will just say, okay, this is one of the sickest patients maybe that I've seen, so probably his perfusion is bad, and maybe there is gastric necrosis, so I will tell my surgeon to look much more carefully about the possibility of gas, or to assess the stomach vitality. But as I said, I would not use the parameter for a prognostic factor. As I say, I use lactate. I don't do it in every patient. I often use it in the bit more complicated patient where my physical exam doesn't tell me a lot, or I'm still doubting there is hypoperfusion. Then I look at lactate, and if lactate is abnormal, then there might be some signs of occult hypoperfusion or hypoperfusion. I see another question. Okay, another question is, what treatment do you advise for a suspected head trauma, for example, following a road traffic accident, and can be inappropriate bradycardia can be the result of it? Yeah, absolutely, absolutely true. So we know that after a traumatic brain injury that is associated with an increased intracranial pressure, it often patient might present, despite being hypoperfused and despite being hypotensive, with a lower heart rate. And that is what we often see and we call the Cushing reflex or Cushing response. Because of an increase of intracranial pressure, the body is going to try to maintain perfusion to the brain by increasing your mean arterial blood pressure, and that will cause a slowing down of the heart rate. So absolutely, a relative or inappropriate bradycardia in a patient that is being, again, hit by car and might suffer from other clinical signs of traumatic brain injury, meaning signs of brain damage, abnormality of the cranial nerve, stupor or coma. Absolutely, that for me, it's always like an alarm bell that there might be increased intracranial pressure. What I would use in this patient, yes, then in those would be the patient in which I would consider as my first treatment, an hypertonic saline bolus, because often those patients, despite being bradycardic, are actually suffering from hypoperfusion. So I need to restore perfusion, also to restore perfusion to the brain self, but I also have to make sure not to worsen again the increased intracranial pressure and traumatic and edema associated to a traumatic brain injury. So I would use a bolus of hypertonic saline. I would start usually with the lower end of the bolus so that I could eventually repeat it. And I will obviously try to assess obviously what is the oxygenation and ventilation of that patient. We know that an increase in CO2 obviously might also alter perfusion to the brain. So I will try to monitor those. If that patient can oxygenate, ventilate well, use my hypertonic saline as an initial bolus, and then obviously reassess the patient. Mannitol, obviously, otherwise we go into a complete different talk, but I would not use mannitol as my first bolus in those patients to treat an increased intracranial pressure, because mannitol, it's a diuretic. So in a patient that is already hypoperfused, obviously, if you use mannitol, yes, you will decrease the intracranial pressure, but you also decrease perfusion to that patient, which means at the end that by decreasing the perfusion to that patient, also the brain will receive less oxygen, so you might even worsen the brain damage associated with a traumatic brain injury. I don't see any other questions, so I would like to thank all of you again for listening to me, and I wish you a great day. Bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Chiara for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.